Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, and today I'm joined by Lieutenant Colonel Michael Novicki from the United States Air Force. His call sign is
POTS.
POTS. Now, because this is a family podcast, we can't ever really go into where call signs come from. So we'll just leave that one a mystery. I'm just joking. Where does it come from?
So actually, that is a very family-friendly call sign. It's short for POTS and PANS. You know, my attitude throughout the Air Force has been one of that kid that would be in the kitchen banging pots and pans together. That's kind of how I've kind of conducted myself throughout the Air Force. It's been quite successful, but that's where it comes from. Pots and pans is too long to say, so POTS has turned out the short name.
Did it start out as POTS and PANS?
It did, but that was maybe for maybe a week or two.
Yeah. And then we just realized this is too tiring.
Exactly.
Three syllables. It's just brutal. Of course, Maverick, the most famous call sign of all time, is also three syllables. So I think you kind of got screwed over there. All right. So Colonel Novicki, Lieutenant Colonel Novicki, is a student here at the Army War College, soon to be an alumnus of the Army War College. And this year, you've been working on artificial intelligence issues in your research as part of a special program here at the War College. So what drew you to that as a topic, just to get started? Why AI?
AI is, so you, when I was doing some of my research and looking for information on the topic, it seems to be really disjointed. There's a lot of really cool, interesting things out there about different technologies. But when I came to it, I was like, hey, how can we use this and leverage it within the military? And just looking into it, it didn't seem like there was a centralized process. And not that I'm proposing that we come up with this, you know, outlandish, you know, 60-pound paper policy, but there wasn't even like a foundation to go out and say, hey, I've got these different AI technologies that I wanted to work on. How can I leverage these? How can I pair them together in a meaningful way? So that was really the draw to it, is just kind of figuring out is how can we kind of come up with a foundation for the military to develop these technologies usefully?
Did your background in the drone community help you, do you think, be a little more open-minded about this? Because I think oftentimes when we think about the drone community, you guys are the harbingers of Skynet, right? Like the end of civilization. Who will bring our robot overlords to us? It's going to be the drone people, right? So
absolutely. So within the Air Force, they're not called drones. They're called remotely piloted aircraft because we control them. They don't do anything without us. So the funny thing is, the drone itself is not what actually drew me to the AI portion of my research. It was really the information we collect. So we collect thousands of hours of video, thousands of hours of other intelligence. And I just realized that a lot of this information falls on the chopping, you know, on the cutting room floor. And it just seemed that AI could significantly help with that. Now, also at the same time, absolutely, artificial intelligence will fly the aircraft eventually one day. But really, it was the data portion that attracted me to the artificial intelligence.
So right now, I think we're struggling a bit, not just in the military, but as a society, with the whole concept of artificial intelligence. It is a term that means a lot of different things to different people. Another term that you're hearing more and more is machine learning. What do you think, where should we start in the military with this? I mean, obviously we use artificial intelligence already. We do everywhere. But as we're thinking about some of the fundamental questions of sort of how do we invest and how do we think about where our research dollars should go, or where should we, you know, operationalize it first? What needs to maybe wait? I think often we struggle to get our arms around some of these questions because AI is kind of a vague term, you know? So when you start with the definitions, you know, for you, what is artificial intelligence?
Well, you're absolutely right. So AI is, it's a little bit like magic, right? You know, hey, if you've got a problem or if you've got a generic something, bring some AI into it. We don't know how, we don't know what that's going to do for us, but sprinkle some AI in it. And that'll fix it. So what my perspective was is that the Air Force, or really the military in general, we make a lot of decisions. So we should focus AI in assisting and helping us make more timely and effective decisions. So when looking at that, I looked at some frameworks, right? So there's the OODA loop that most military people are very familiar with. You've got the observe, orient, decide, and act. And looking at the more detailed version of that loop, it just doesn't lend itself really to the technology. So I went out and I found Mika Inslee. Dr. Mika Inslee was the chief scientist of the United States Air Force, and she developed what was called a situational awareness tool. And it had really five steps, and that was perceiving the data, comprehending that data, projecting the futures or of that data, or, you know, based on that data, and then making a decision and acting on that data. So that was a framework that I pulled, but it really, I think the military needs to focus on making more timely, effective decisions. If that's the framework we use, great. If not, focus on something similar to it.
Okay, so let's go through those five again. All right, so first, perceive the data. Second, interpret the data. Third, use the data to project some future condition.
Yes.
Assuming you do nothing, right? Fourth is make some decision about an action. And five is act.
Absolutely.
Okay. So where do you think artificial intelligence right now can add the most value for the military in those five areas?
So looking at the technology, looking at what humans can do, looking at what technology does, the amount of data that is available in the world today is impossible to be fully comprehended, fully ingested by a human. So perceiving that data or ingesting that data into your computer systems, whether that data be plain text, whether it be databases, whether it be visual information, bringing that in is definitely a very machine-oriented type of a project advantage to the machine. Additionally, comprehending some of that data as well. So comprehending is taking your goals, what do you want to do in life, and then understanding, okay, I've got a whole bunch of radar blips. Those are all aircraft.
What do they mean?
Exactly. Right. Are those enemy aircraft? Are they hostile to me? Mm-hmm. Are they, even if they are hostile, are they relevant to my current combat situation? So comprehending that situation, I think taking those disjointed pieces of data, whether it be visual information, radar, metadata, plain text, even understanding your rules of engagement. You know, IBM's done a lot of work with unstructured data and bringing that in. So that's obviously to the machine. Advantages right there. Where I think you leave the machine advantage is projecting the futures. And I think a lot of people, when they hear project the future with AI, they think that this is strictly a scientific process. Like we're going to go Jomini on these guys and make, you know, war a scientific process. And really it's helping perceive that data, comprehend that data, and then give it to a person to help them make better projections or most dangerous co-analysis or most likely enemy, you know, co-analysis. Okay. Considerations. So once you get into that projection of the future, I think that's where the machine loses some of its advantages because of the way it processes data and because of the way that humans process data.
In that stage, in the projection and decision stage, actually, in those two stages, maybe AI right now can be quite helpful, not so much in doing the projection or making the decision, but in red teaming or kind of auditing your projection or your decision, right? So you can kind of team with an AI that would say, hey, you apparently have decided this based on my AI understanding. I think that's an error, and these are the reasons, right?
I think you could use that, but I think even more so is I used a helicopter landing assault as an example. So a very rudimentary part of doing a helicopter landing assault would be to find a flat space that could, you know, support helicopters when they land. So let's say we're going to go assault city X, and the AI says, hey, I found 22 flat surfaces that meet the criteria. Well, a human might look at five of those and realize, well, they're soccer fields inside of the military bases that are very strongholds at that point. So I think from that perspective is perceiving the data, comprehending, and maybe presenting the human less options than they might originally have derived themselves, and then have the human apply that very comprehensive picture that they have that the computer doesn't, and say, yeah, those 22 options you've just given me are, you know, of those, six of them are absolutely out. So instead of considering 1,000 landing zones around the city, the AI has helped it narrow it down to maybe 15 or 16, and then you can apply those real rigorous criteria to your co-development, co-analysis.
So you actually just hit on a real weakness in the way that we talk about artificial intelligence and how we want to preserve human dominance in certain areas of the decision space, right? So let's talk about the decision to use lethal force, all right? Because that's a common one right now that people say, yeah, by golly, we got to keep the human in the loop, right? Like, the robots can tell us all kinds of stuff, but I'm going to press that button to decide to take a life, because that's a human decision. That was my, you know, undefensible argument voice.
I liked it. That sounded very academic. Yeah.
So you, when we were talking before, you gave me a really good example that I thought about a lot. So you're a pilot in an F-22. Okay, this is an aircraft that has weapons that can shoot things, destroy things way beyond the visual range of a human being. So your aircraft, you're flying this airplane, and your aircraft tells you that there are a bunch of enemy aircraft, you know, in this place that you can't see. You can't see them, but the radar sees them, and it's giving you targeting information. And based on all that, and let's say you're in an active conflict environment, and aircraft aren't supposed to be in this place. So in that situation, your decision is basically, do I believe what the computer is telling me enough to then release weapons, right? Just like shoot at these things.
Absolutely.
And so my question is, are you actually making the decision to use force? Because if you predictably make a decision to use force based on certain inputs and the computer controls the provision of those inputs, then in some way the computer is deciding whether force is used.
No, you're absolutely right. So even looking at the decision process and the ethics of decision processes, have we ethically, you know, perceived the data? How do the algorithms that comprehend it, do they ethically, you know, meet our terms? But at the end of the day, as you said, we've perceived this data through a computer. The computer has said, yes, that is a hostile aircraft. It's, you know, Russian, Chinese, whatever enemy state you happen to be engaging at the time. We've said that aircraft is going to try to attack us or harm us in some way. And then you have, based on all this data, you've never seen it with your eyes, you've never touched it with your hands, engage this aircraft. So the idea that we have to touch something or see something is one we're already comfortable with not doing when engaging the enemy and employing lethal force. So certainly more research has to be done on that, because our ethics are our ethics, right? So we have to adhere to our ethics, but I do think we have to really explore the idea of allowing not only for us to see the data and say, yes, I agree with that, but for allowing artificial intelligence to employ lethal force.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess, you know, what are rules of engagement, right? Rules of engagement are basically, it's like a checklist of conditions that you need to meet to use force or something. And if the machine is checking the boxes, then you're not really making a choice whether you use force. You're just waiting for the machine to say conditions to use force have been met, and now you press a button. But I don't know that that's like, I said, it just doesn't feel like that's human control of the decision.
Even under that system, I mean, the United States has made errors before in shooting down aircraft that were not, in fact, the aircraft they thought they were shooting down. And when you look at the spectrum of warfare, a T-72 tank pointing west in eastern Ukraine is probably a Russian tank. That's probably a very hostile piece of equipment. So when you look at the spectrum of war, this high intensity conflict, you know, state on state, I think it's much easier right now to maybe give AI those decision processes. Now, when you're in Afghanistan and you're looking at people alongside the road, that's a much more, I think that's really a limitation.
The more political, right? I mean, it's like the more political the decisions.
Political, but I also think, like, when you're asking a machine to think about something or analyze something, is, dude, I've identified a very specific combat vehicle. There's only one purpose for this vehicle. It's pointing in a hostile direction. It's shooting at people that are my friends. Whereas in these insurgencies, a lot of times there's a lot of deep analysis, and the decision to make that is not very clear cut, even at the human level, you know, to make that decision.
It's kind of like the difference between policing using speed cameras and then having some kind of robot that's like, you know, managing the street corner. Right. I mean, it's just that those are different challenges for police. And the speed camera is pretty straightforward, right? It was like, hey, car going X over the limit, I'm going to photograph, and they get a ticket in the mail.
Yeah.
I Thank mean, you, if, state of Maryland, by the way.
Appreciate
gotten
it.
A couple of those. And then on the other hand, right, it's like, you know, the street corner is complicated. I mean, it's, you know, are those kids, what are those kids up to, right? It's like, are they, should I talk to them as a cop, or sort of just tell them, disperse, you know?
No, absolutely. A group of kids that are setting up a lemonade stand might look very similar to a group of kids selling drugs or
up
other.
Up to no good.
Up to no good. Exactly. So that's where you have to have that definite human interaction. However, like you said, the speed camera, if you're doing 26 and the speed limit's 25, you're speeding.
Yeah.
And obviously more leeway in some other states. Maryland, I'm guessing, is not one of those states with the leeway.
Well, it's funny. They actually tell you on the ticket, like, how... why you got the ticket, right? It's like, and I think if I remember correctly, it's 12 miles an hour, more than 12 miles over the limit. So they're basically telling you, look, you can go up to this, but beyond that, we're going to get you and you deserve it. And frankly, yeah, it seems fair, right?
Yeah. it's these top down versus bottom up learning, but so it's a very if then else.
Yeah.
If they're speeding,
yep.
Send them a ticket. Else, don't send them a ticket. Whereas, you know, interacting with humans and trying to assess what they're really doing is not an if-then-else. That is a, hey, I've seen people before. I understand what dangerous activity looks like. I understand what friendly activity looks like. And you learn these over time.
So one of the things I like about your discussion of AI and in focusing on decision-making is that oftentimes when we're talking about artificial intelligence, we talk about it in terms of things. You know, things in the military that have guns or missiles or whatever, and are we going to let those things, you know, kill people without having a human being intercede to authorize the decision? And you're saying, look, let's stop kind of talking about things and let's focus on choice just in general, fundamentally. That's very interesting. It also opens up some interesting possibilities for further work in areas that we don't often think about, I believe, and as being ripe for disruption by AI. For example, the staff and sort of staff processes of the military, right? Like operational design, you know, how do we plan an operation? How do we evaluate the progress of an operation? Do you think that AI has something to contribute in those areas?
Without question on these staffs. And I would say even my earlier example about a helicopter assault is, I mean, that's an A3 or G3 or, you know, whatever three is planning this is, that's one of their things is identify these COAs. But if you look at the AI staffs and you look at the amount of data they ingest, there's a lot of data and they can't ingest it all. And then when they do develop these COAs, the typical framework...
Just to clarify, what's a COA?
I'm sorry. A COA is a course of action. So when you have your military folks developing these courses of actions, if you look at some of the decision processes, you know, absent of artificial intelligence, you have these rationality, bounded rationality. And one of the weaknesses within bounded rationality is when they're developing these courses of actions, typically, and every military person has seen this slideshow before, it's like, hey, here's your three COAs.
Yeah.
Here's the one we really want to go here. Here's the two that are going to make you feel like you're about to make a decision. But because of human limitations on analyzing data and truly wargaming out each and every COA to its fullest potential, typically we don't have that ability to come up with more than one real COA, so we kind of limited ourselves from the get-go. By using artificial intelligence, these staffs can now hopefully only focus on the decisions that humans are good at right now based on current technologies, and you can truly come up with maybe three or four or more courses of action when you're going up against your enemy, really truly war game each of those out, and then truly pick the one that achieves your objectives, because at the end of the day, more than likely is the technology we become that the primary human purpose will be to define the goals. What are our human defined goals? And what are we trying to achieve out of this? And then AI will ingest that information, comprehend it, project the futures to help us better achieve those goals and make those decisions.
So that term you mentioned earlier, bounded rationality, that was, I believe, coined by Herbert Simon, and he described bounded rationality as arising from three conditions. And what he was saying was, look, this idea of rational man or rational decision maker, this is an illusion. We aren't rational, right? Because here's what rationality requires, right? To make a rational choice, to optimize your choice, you need to select the best option based on your current information from all available choices. And he said, there's no way that we can ever understand all of the choices that are available to us. Like if someone comes to you and says, hey, I got option one, I got option two, I got option three. Well, what about four through N, right? And so what you're saying is one of the advantages of AI is AI can actually develop like the four through N options and help you kind of with some comparative analysis to winnow that down to a subset that might end up being, hey, out of options one through N, it looks like 3, 29, and 47 are really promising. So let's look at those.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, all resources are finite. So, you know, AI is not going to allow us to do, you know, right now it might allow us to do 100. In the future, it's going to be a million, but never infinite number. I think the other thing it might allow us to do is have truly unique courses of actions to choose from. Because a lot of times, you know, course of action one is we're going to go to the center. Course of action two is slightly left. Course of action three is slightly right. So you might be able to look at this and really come up with COAs that is we're going to go to the center. Then we're going to come wide, you know, over here. And the other thing I think you can do is you might be able to kind of say, hey, give me some crazy COAs, you know, some things that I haven't thought of. And when these COAs come back, your AI, the assumption is right now maybe some sort of human interaction to say, hey, these codes have a certain percentage of achieving the goals that you've defined for us. And if you have a COA that comes back and says, hey, you've got a 95% chance of achieving your goals with this COA, a military commander might come back and say, I'm riskier than that. And might be able to extend their goals further and look at those and have the computer come back and say, hey, this is an 80% likelihood of success with this COA with these enhanced goals that you've put forward. So moving your goalpost a little bit around and also creating truly unique COAs throughout the spectrum, I think is something that artificial intelligence could help us do in the military realm.
So if you're sitting with, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, right, who's trying to make really good, and the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force as well, because this is going to be also in their portfolio. So really good investment decisions. Where would you say, hey, you know, based on my understanding, here's where we really ought to explore making significant artificial intelligence investments now?
They've made some in the Chief Data Office there. The United States Air Force established a Chief Data Officer, and their focus is on understanding how to gather data, how to consolidate it. Build data lakes, as they're called, so everybody has access to the data they need.
So that's actually the first and, to some extent, the second steps in the Ensley model that you were describing.
It is, and right. That's a really good step. So that feeds the next one. So the next step, looking at comprehension, one of the projects that's very popular out there now that people have heard is Maven. This is a project that whose primary focus, as I understand it, is they're taking video data and instead of having a human watch it, right now you have 2 to 3 humans watching every predator feed in the Air Force. They're having the computer do this, and they're having to point out cars, other moving objects, identifying, you know, certain things. And one of the things that has helped that is they're doing this learning data. So they've taken a lot of people, look at the videos, they click on it and say, yes, that is indeed a car. The computer now continues to learn. It is better with that. So learning how the data will help us is certainly a good thing. Comprehending that data obviously is a very big thing, and not just comprehending as is that a car or is that a piece of machinery, but maybe assigning it a rule of engagement, right? This unstructured data, bringing that in and saying, hey, not only is this probably a hostile vehicle, but it meets all the current criteria of rules engagement right now. So continuing with that research, but I think with the future projections, I think we have not done a very good job of creating tools that will take this perceived data, this comprehended data, and say, hey, here are some futures that may happen, And you know, we talked about the future earlier. There's two parts of projecting. There's if left uninterfered, this is what would happen with the future. Well, normally that's not the future we want, right? We have to intervene. So how do I go through that future, change the things I want, and have the computer come back and say, yes, this is what I project the future would be based on these interventions that you've just made. So I would say that projecting the future, providing tools for the U.S. military to use and saying, hey, this is the future that we can project, and then providing tools to intervene with that future and see what would happen based on our interventions, whether it be military action, you know, socio-political, all those sorts of areas there.
Was there anything that you found? I mean, I imagine there were, so let me, what was the most surprising thing that you found as you were working on this?
The most surprising thing was just kind of the absence of strategies by the U.S. government, the absence of any really unifying guidance by the military or the U.S. government on how we're going to implement. There's some different strategies out there. There's CSIS put out a strategy. There is another strategy out there. The National Science and Technology Council Network and Info Technology Research and Development Subcommittee. They put out a strategy in 2016. But really just the absence of strategies and the absence of specifics in these strategies. For instance, most of the strategies all agree that we need to invest in further research and development of AI, but none of them give anything like, hey, this is how we should decide. So using this decision model is you can now kind of look through your decision model, say, hey, my goal is to make more timely and effective decisions. Where are my bottlenecks? You know, the Air Force, we have more data than we know what to do with. There is no clear pathway for every piece of data that we collect to go to a comprehension tool. And then even more so is, like, as I mentioned, is we're starting to get some comprehension tools. We have no projection tools. And then even more so, our decision tools, and associated not just with the technology of each of those steps is, what are the ethics? What are the legal implications? What are the moral considerations that we should take into account? So when you look at these projects, you can kind of say like, hey, we're overinvested in this area. Let's divest in some of this area and vector some of that money over here. And whether it be decisions, we can say, well, the technology isn't there yet, or it's about to be there. But even worse is the technology is there and we don't know how we're going to use it. We don't know the moral, ethical implications and how we're going to use it. So that was one of the surprising things, is just the lack of a foundation that gives someone kind of a common ground to work with, but not so centralized that it becomes sort of a communist run, shoe factory.
You will make AI. It will do this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you look at tanks, if you look at aircraft, you know, with a tank, you've got people that are concerned about propulsion. You have people that are concerned about armament. You have people concerned about sensors. Well, the same way in AI is that you have people that are worried about perception, comprehension, decision-making and projection technologies. And then somebody at the end is going to try to tie those in together to kind of come up with a weapon system to use.
Well, Potts, Lieutenant Colonel Novicki, thank you very much for joining us in the War Room podcast today. I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
Well, thanks for having me, Andrew. I really appreciate this opportunity and look forward to talking more AI in the future.
Thank you all for joining us today in the War Room, and we hope you'll join us next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.